Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. Today, we are excited to have Julie Benezet on the phone with us, and Julie has devoted her professional life to building companies, real estate, and career. She has currently worked as an executive consultant, coach, and teacher following 25 years in business and law. Additionally, she is the founder of The Journey of Not Knowing, a leadership development program that teaches its executives how to navigate the new. She speaks and writes extensively on leadership. And her book, The Journey of Not Knowing, How 21st Century Leaders Can Chart a Course Where There Is None, received a gold medal from the Independent Book Publishers Association and was a 2016 Forward Indies finalist. Julie spent 4 years as a member of the Amazon.com leadership team that brought the company from the early steep ramp-up phase to its emergence as an established business. As its vice president, corporate resources, and director of global real estate, she is credited with leading the delivery of over 7 million square feet worldwide with the supporting corporate infrastructure in just 2 years. Before joining Amazon.com, Julie built and raised capital for businesses and real estate representing a broad range of industries of diverse sizes, from the Fortune 100 companies to startups. She practiced law in New York and Seattle. For 10 years, Julie led the Challenges of Leadership program for executives at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. She has appeared in numerous publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, TechRepublic.com, and The Zweig Letter. She has served on many profit and nonprofit boards, including the Zell Lurie Real Estate Center at Wharton, Sparling Inc., and now Stantec and the Crew Network Foundation. She holds an LLB and an MS from McGill University and a bachelor's degree from Cornell University. After many years of enjoying the intensity of urban life, she moved her base of operations in 2013 to a calmer but no less active Southern Oregon, where she lives with her husband and two orange cats. When she is not working, she loves to garden, read mysteries, explore new wineries, and wander through compelling physical environments. Thank you so much for joining us today, Julie.
Thank you.
That is quite an impressive bio you have there. So talk to me. How on earth did we wind up here? How did you wind up becoming an expert on how to reinvent yourself in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think I live my creed. When I listened to my biography, I said, can't this girl keep a job? But I hope the good news for your listeners is I've had many jobs, and all of them were by choice. And they followed a pattern of pursuing the new. I was always intrigued by something that was different and happening. And when I was writing my book, I had to have the compelling opening scene, I was told. And they said, what is the thing that describes you? And I sat down and I thought about it. And I came up with the image of me in my treehouse when I was 9 years old. And I used to spend my summers redesigning my treehouse and then climbing up in it and thinking about, how could I make this bigger, higher, better? And it became a theme of my life, is striving for looking for things that where I can make things better. So in my career, I started in psychology because I wanted to make myself better. And trying to figure things out. And I was also fascinated with the behavior of other people. So I pursued that and ended up in the graduate school going after my PhD thinking, I've arrived. This is fantastic. I'm going to be a psychologist. That's it. And then I started to practice psychology. And I realized that the longer I was in it, the more I wanted to run a clinic rather than be a clinician. And I think what tipped me off was a couple things. One was I started to agree with my my patients when they would tell me about terrible things that had happened in their lives, and I'd be sitting there thinking, wow, given your life, you should be psychotic. That was the best choice. And I thought, you know, when you're 20 and stupid, 20-something and stupid, it's a lot to get over. But then I had the occasion, living in Montreal, where my landlord raised my rent by 25% without improving the premises at all.
Wow.
And I was aggrieved. And I thought, wow, that took guts. So my roommate and I hauled him into the Montreal rental board, and I was introduced to my landlord and my son, the lawyer, who was a very slick guy who looked at my roommate and I and thought, a couple girls. And so he very condescendingly started to ask me questions about all the comparable apartments in the area to prove to me that clearly I was not paying enough and needed to pay 25% more. Well, in those days, I lived out of two suitcases and a box of books, because I'd been forever. So it was easy for me to move, and I had happened to have occupied every one of the apartments he named. So
wow.
I scrapped them. And finally, he gave the final salvo was, well, have you lived in 3505 DeRoche? And I said, well, yes, of course. I just moved out of there, and I described it to a T. And when he looked at me, he said, you have. I said, I have lived in that apartment. Well, we won a 30% rollback in rent, and I walked out of there thinking, this is great. I can get paid to argue. And so it told me that I needed to make a switch. So I ended up going to law school, so where I could get paid to argue and to go build compelling cities. And I ended up going into law, and I became a finance lawyer, where I spent all my time capitalizing deals, capitalizing real estate companies, you name it, and making deals. And what I loved about it was that to raise money, you have to listen to people's dreams. What is it that they're trying to do? What do they want to make that's exciting and new? And so that fit me quite well for a while. But what happened was, after a time, I wanted to walk out of the office with them. I didn't want to live vicariously anymore documenting what they were talking about. I wanted to actually go do it. So I thought about, well, what do I like to do? And when you have, when you're looking for what you want to do in your life as a career, it's important to pay attention to what you do in your free time. And I spent my free time cruising construction sites. I would stare at it, evaluate the building. I read up on every project that was in town. I'd never been in real estate. I was not from a real estate family, but I loved spaces, and I loved design environment. So I started to say, well, real estate development, that sounds pretty interesting. And I met a couple people in the industry, and then I became pregnant. Mm. Well, I was 1 year away from partnership at what is the brass ring in law, to be a partner in a major law firm. And I was not happy, and I was pregnant, but there was. But at 5 months pregnant, I got a call from the top real estate development firm in town with whom I'd never worked, but I met a couple of their people at one time. I said, we have a position here that would use your peculiar mix of traits. We need somebody who could be a lawyer here and raise money. I went, well, I'd rather on a short time frame here. He said, oh, come on over. So I walked over, and 2 months later, they gave me an offer, and at 7 months pregnant, I waddled into the new place. And there is something about when you're 7 months pregnant, and they took me seriously. They sent me straight into all those deals that have been stuck. And when I came in very visibly pregnant, they couldn't argue with me when I said, this is a time-limited offer. We need to get this done. And so we did. Well, I continued that, and that moved me from law to business and realized that not living vicariously was a shoe that fit. And I spent the next era of my career in business, building different consulting firms, real estate firms, et cetera, finally, in being through a serendipitous encounter, ended up being Amazon's first real estate executive in 1998. So that was the third leg of my career, where I got to build the worldwide platform of real estate and lead the team that got us there. Everything was new. I was, my brain hurt. We were thinking so hard, but it was a great experience. And it's a very combative company. It's challenging to work with, and it's also an incredible company to work for. But after 80-hour weeks and 4 years of this, I decided I was just mentally flatlining, and I needed to make a switch. So the turning point of that, and, you know, when you decide to switch out of something, there's a small thing. It's the straw that breaks the camel's back. There's a small thing that happens that makes you finally decide, and it was getting into an argument for the sixth time over some minor thing with one of our subsidiaries in Europe, where five times we'd argued over it and each time come to an agreement, and then they'd reneged. And when we got into it for the sixth time, I thought, that's it. I'm done. I just don't feel like getting into the combat zone yet again. So I decided to leave, and I'm going to say Amazon is a hard place to stay at, and it's a hard place to leave. And everybody who's ever worked there feels the same. You do your best work there and your hardest work there, and it takes its toll. But I had another influence, which was my high school age daughter, who I wanted to spend the last 2 years of high school with her, and that was the right choice. So moved off, and the final phase was sitting at a Wharton meeting, and a colleague leaned over and said, I am putting together a leadership development class at Harvard for executives. Would you like to come help me do that?
Wow, that's great.
don't they have experts in this field? And I wasn't being cute or coy. I mean, I believe in taking chances, but I also believe in telling the truth. And so he says, well, Julie, your business, you work with executives, because I'd come out of Amazon having spent a life as an executive or be with executives, and I found what I did most of the time in my life was to listen to them and to be a sounding board. So it was a shoe that fit. So I looked at him and I said, well, it's not that I don't have opinions on leadership. I just don't travel with a stump speech. And he said, oh, well, okay. Well, I have to talk to somebody else, but if I'll see how that goes, and I'll call you back in 36 hours. And I thought, lose that number. I was really terrified by the prospect. Well, 36 hours later, he says, you're in. I want you to do this. And 10 years later, I'd finally left after teaching this program that we put together and ran it for 10 years. And so I spent the last 15 years being a leadership consultant and teacher and now author.
That's incredible. Yeah, no, it's such an incredible story. And I love that there were so many points there, I think, that our listeners could benefit from. One of the most interesting ones, that it's something I personally would discourage somebody from doing, but I would love your two cents, is when you left being pregnant, did you have any reservations about the fact that you might be mistreated or you might miss some of the opportunities that you would have had you stayed at your company? I know I have a friend going through that right now. She's 6 months pregnant and ready to make a move to a new job, and she's an executive as well. But the consideration is, you're going into the unknown plus the unknown of having a child. How did that impact you?
Well, it was my first child, so I underestimated what it was to be a parent. So I think ignorance was bliss. The second one was I was having a pretty easy pregnancy, so I, again, underestimated it. But it's a great question. I have to say I was so determined to do what this new thing. The company that I was going to was going to build this amazing high-rise office building with one of my favorite architectural firms. And the idea of being associated and getting to work with a group of people like that was magical. And I felt that the magic in the change would be enough for me to help me power through. And I also realize, and you always have to wait, I take risks, but they're not cavalier risks. I think the best way to take risks is to be rather conservative, get as much information as you can, then plug your nose and go. But one of the things that I figured out with the help of a mentor is that where I was going was, as he said, it's like a lateral. You will be even more valuable should you decide to come back. So go try this, and if it doesn't work, we'll take you back. And so I had a front and a back door. And that has been the pattern. I've done that twice in my career life, and it worked both times.
Yeah, I think that's so important is we see a lot of people on the recruitment side of things who burn bridges. They don't give adequate time or rationale for why they're leaving, and then they have no backdoor to come back to. Not that I'm an advocate of taking a counteroffer or going back to a place, but I think that it's always in your highest and best good to leave on excellent terms with whoever you leave a job for, especially when there's a risk involved. So I think that was a very smart strategic move on your part to make sure that there was as little risk as possible in that particular situation.
Thank you. Well, I do believe in keeping your options open, and it's just too expensive to make enemies in the work world. That always comes back to bite you. Nobody's perfect. You're not going to love everybody the same. But it's important to find a way to work with people and to keep the doors open to them. The one bridge I burned in my life was my thesis advisor in grad school, and I'll just spare you the story, but he was just so disgusting. It wasn't a harassment thing or anything. It was an intellectual disagreement about something. And I thought, I'll never need him again. And I was young and full of myself. And 30 years later, there came an incident where I would have benefited from a reference from him.
Wow. It's so funny how it comes full circle. You slam one door in somebody's face, you might
keep
have to reopen
open.
It. Yeah. I think that's a great point, and I think it's something that we're seeing a lot right now, whether we're talking about baby boomers, Gen Xers, or millennials, is that people aren't being respectful of careers. It's been a very curious time to be a recruiter in this market, because I feel like prior to the recession that happened, of course, in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13, people really valued longevity and having a job and getting the gold watch and staying long term. And now I think that it's kind of a dog-eat-dog world more than it was before, where it's me and I'm out for myself and you're not going to keep me long-term anyways, so I'm going to leave you before you leave me. And I'd love to hear your perspective on that. How are you seeing that impact people who are trying to job hunt in the 21st century? Is it still imperative to create longevity or create at least lasting relationships with these people that you work with, whether it's for 3 months or 20 years, or is that no longer a consideration in today's market?
Well, I think it's definitely a consideration, because whether somebody stays a long period of time or a short period of time, if they move to, they're still in the same business community. We are so hyper-connected in the 21st century that nobody really disappears from view. So you will come up with these people again in your career, and to develop a relationship and create value with that person, I think, is essential. I know the attitude that you are talking about, and I hear baby boomers tear their hair out regularly. What? These millennials, they're just so cavalier. They don't care. They'd much rather go play tennis than work. And maybe they're right about that. And I think we do have to rework our attitude towards what work is about. It's not about showing up and being it's there for 9 hours every day to prove that you're a hard worker. It is contributing to where you're at and having the attitude that wherever you're working, it's important to you, and it's important to you that you do something good for them. And I think that is what gets missed, is whether you're there for a long period of time or a short period of time, make sure that you contribute value, because you never know, A, when you will need then, or B, when it benefits you. That is how you grow. The people who are very cavalier, I find, are often very disaffected, and they're not getting the benefit they need out of their jobs, so they don't grow in them, and of course they become disaffected. It becomes a vicious cycle.
Good point. And so that said, what is the work world today? What are we looking at in the 21st century, and how is that different than 5, 10, 20, or even 40 years ago?
Well, it's a great question. Work world 20 years ago was very local. It was something where everybody you worked with was around you. They were connected by physical presence. They were down the street or they're in the same community. That when you needed things, you sourced from your community. And everything was known. 21st century, we are hyper-connected. We're global. We're diverse. Ideas, talent, and money can come from anywhere. And it means that things are changing all the time and much is not known. So what has happened, I see, that is very different from the 20th century, is in the 21st century, you have to be very entrepreneurial. And that means really looking at what's happening out there with your stakeholders, whether it's your employees, your customers, your community, or whatever, and seeing what it is that they need and figuring out how to meet that need, knowing that it's going to evolve, which means you have to evolve with it. So the 21st century job success really requires flexibility. You need to be able to flex with what the market's telling you. Your own company could reorg, be restructured, or bought at any time. There's a lot of that going on. And your job could change with like it or not. So it's for you. It behooves you to take on the attitude of, how do I pay attention? How do I look at who it is that I'm trying to satisfy or give value that will, in fact, allow me to have a healthy career?
I think that an example of that, one of the things about you being flexible when you were sharing with us a little bit about your history and how you got to where you were, is the job that you took on, or rather the endeavor of the Wharton Business School and teaching leaders, it was something that was completely unknown to you. And again, as you self-professed, you didn't see yourself as an expert or a leader in the field. What would you say to people as far as being flexible when they're offered an opportunity that could, quite frankly, scare them, but at the same time, it excites them? How would you suggest that a job seeker is flexible and approaches the unknown or the uncomfortableness of something that they might be great at, but it scares them?
Well, I'm laughing because I'm here because I'm staring at a wall of books. there is an axiom that I adopted early in my career, is would is better than could. And somebody says, would you do something? It means that you don't know how to do it, but you're willing to learn. If they say, could you do something, that means you already know. And so I did a lot of woulds along the way. And the premise of my book is, whether you're a leader or not, is succeeding is being comfortable with the discomfort of not knowing. That when you don't know the outcome, it means you're going to go into the place of new ideas and discovery. And it means that you don't know it's going to be go well, whether it's going to go terribly, or something, and you have to course correct. But the idea is that it's scary or uncomfortable, and they have to be okay with it. That's how you learn. And when I was asked to do that leadership class, he didn't say, could you? He said, would you? So I thought, that's a lie. I would do this. And the thing I'm smiling at in my office right now is the 40 books of leadership I sat down during the next 4 months to read. And
wow,
I expertized myself in everything that had been written about leadership presently and from the past. And so by the time I entered that classroom, I was ready to go. I was scared to death. I mean, I probably sweat my weight in perspiration getting ready for it. But it was so exciting that I was able to do it. That when you go through this, it's important that you have a dream. And my dream was, I really thought that the way to succeed is to lead things well, and whether it's myself or others. And if I could teach others to lead well, then the organizations they lead have a prospect of succeeding. And that excited me. And I'm the daughter of an educator, so I'm sort of tainted by this DNA. But that allowed me to push through all that scariness and keep my rear end in a chair and read those books and figure out what I was going to say and manage to stand up straight when I walked in front of those 25 executives and start speaking. I was very excited at the end of the day, let me tell you. But it's important to embrace that discomfort and know it's okay.
Yeah, I think that in society, one of the interesting things that I've at least noticed as I've gotten older is that in some cases, being courageous is rewarded. But in many cases, if you speak up or if you try something, it's seen as failure if you get shot down in a meeting with executives and they say, no, Jim or Sue, that was not a great idea. And then people go, okay, well, then clearly I'm not meant to speak up in a meeting. And it can start even as early as childhood. And I think what you're pointing to is when we take the time to actually be courageous, to delve into the unknown, the things that we're not 100% certain about, but still have faith or certainty at some level that we'll do everything we can to be prepared, I think that might be one of the characteristics of not only great leaders, but great entrepreneurs, or even if you're an employee and you're not in a management role or leadership or executive role, it's the characteristic of greatness, in my opinion, is being willing to dive into the unknown and be courageous even in the face of failure or people telling you you can't.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I tell people failure is your friend. The road to success is paved with failure, and any entrepreneur would tell you that. The lubricant used on your bike tires and so on, WD-40, it was 40 stands for the number of failed products you had before they succeeded.
I had no idea.
The bubble wrap was originally designed as a wallpaper, imagine, and it just wasn't working and wasn't working and wasn't working. And finally, they say, somebody literally had to send a box of something out. And they said, well, we got this stupid wallpaper over here. Just wrap it in that. And they wrapped it in that, and voila, you know, several zillion dollars later, somebody was very wealthy because of failed wallpaper. So I think that the thing that failure is important to say, okay, what can I learn from it? And something that's important is what it does is it gives you an opportunity for a redo. It is something, if it didn't turn out, what happened? And it's usually that for one reason or another, you didn't understand your stakeholder. If, for example, if you go in and give a presentation and it just doesn't land, that people are looking bored, they're reading their phones, they're rolling their eyes, or later on your supervisor comes and tells you, say, that was just a disaster, is the first thing is to not to get into a defensive place and personalize it. That in my book, I talk about these things called hooks, which are defensive behaviors that give you near-term comfort. But what they do is they take you away from the discomfort that's going to get you on the road to bigger things. And one of these defensive behaviors, they're all very normal ones. They're micromanagement, perfectionism, personalizing, conflict avoidance, and so on. But personalizing is if you hear that person's feedback as saying, you are terrible. That was a terrible presentation. You are terrible. And you look at it through the lens of your self-esteem rather from the lens of what actually went on in there. So you can take a deep breath, the side of that self-flagellation, and take another look. What you can learn is it could be that, for example, that they had heard something similar the month before and you had not reviewed what other things they've been exposed to. It could be that it was complicated for them, that they hadn't had the 101 version. It could be, and this happened to me once, and I say I'm not smarter than anybody. I just have more skid marks down my back. But it's when I learned that the initiative I was talking about had been tried by a guy in the room at another company, and he'd been fired because of it. Everybody knew the story except me. So the gift of failure is a chance to go back and say, okay, what did I miss? What do I need to learn? And what can I make better? And that's why I think failure is so valuable.
Yeah, I love what you just said, Julie, about not personalizing it. That's, I think, one of the greatest falls that we continually make as human beings. I see where I just did it recently a couple of weeks ago, where you can take, if you take it from the perspective of they're doing it to me, or it's about me, or they hurt me, you're actually giving your power away. You're treating the person, the situation, the group as stronger or more powerful than you, where in reality, if you can just say, that happened, and it happened because it happened, without getting into the personalization, as you said, of it, I think that's a good way to hang on to your power in a situation that could occur as disempowering or negative, and be able to turn it into a positive and ask yourself, what was the lesson? How can I learn from this? And like you said, that I loved your stories about failure. I had no idea about the bubble wrap or other instances, but we hear them all the time in business. Thomas Edison had 10,000 failures before he created the light bulb. Yet when we fail, we create, like, we're the only ones who have ever failed. And because we failed, we're going to burn in hell and die a miserable death, where we're really not. We're going to live. We'll show up tomorrow and have our coffee at the same time tomorrow, but we will survive it. And I think our brain just doesn't understand that.
Yeah, I've once made a list for an association I was giving a speech to, and I said, pioneering your career, 10 rules of the road. And one of them was, remember, tomorrow is another day. nobody dies of these things. The next day, everybody will have had a night's sleep. They will have different things they have to pay attention to. You might have actually figured out what you're really supposed to do. There are lots of ways that these things go past. And when I was at Amazon, I had the advantage of being a little bit older than everybody else. And I'd been through so many failures, I was very experienced in it. So when terrible things would happen, at least they thought it was terrible, they'd run around saying, the sky is falling. And I kind of feel, it's not that I didn't feel badly about it, but I also knew that the sky was not falling and we were going to fix it. And let's just take a deep breath, stay with me. We will find another way, and we'll feel better as a result.
Yeah, I think that's great feedback. It's about, you know, the fight or flight, the amygdala side of our brain that literally has it collapsed from millions of years of evolution, that a tiger or a bear is going to come and attack us. And if we can just allow a breath and pause, and, you know, even sometimes I've found writing that email that is right there on the tip of your tongue, but just not sending it. You know, 14 years earlier in my career, I would not only compose the email that had all of my thoughts about how the sky was falling, I would actually send it. And I think maturity has taught me, and many self-development and personal development classes, that you write the email and you send it to yourself instead of whoever the intended recipient is. And then it avoids a lot of drama and chaos unnecessarily.
Do you remember where there used to be some kind of function where you could recall your email?
Oh, that was the best.
It sent a message to the receiver that the thing had been recalled, which made it worse.
Yes. And then you're like, wait, what was in that email? Now you're trying to find it. Why wasn't it intended
for me?
Well,
now you especially wanted it, exactly. But yes, I have written many emails that have sat in my draft file and been very grateful that I did not send them.
Yeah, it's just about taking that time to pause. So tell our job seekers a little bit about it. How then do you even approach creating a career or job hunting in the 21st century with all of these unknowns, all of these failures and inconsistencies? What steps can you take to begin to create your career in the 21st century?
I think the important things are to know your life story, your values, and your dreams. We spend a lot of time looking at lists and things like that, and not enough time paying attention to how we are wired. What is it that we love to do? What is it that guides us? Do we like to spend our time with people? Do we like to work with our hands? When we were young, what was it that made us happy? And I spent hours in the sandbox building model cities. Again, I had nothing around me that told me about that, but it's what I intuitively love to do. first thing is to trust that your knowledge is in there and spend time paying attention. But the second thing is also think about how you like to spend your time. Are you a highly social person? Are you someone who likes to work in teams? Are you someone who likes to pull a group together and go forward? Or do you like to sit in the corner in a more introverted way and do analysis of things and honor that? And then pay attention again to your dreams. I spent several years with people helping them to reinvent their careers, and we would look back at what their triumphs and defeats were and see what we learned from them, and then figure out where to take them from there. And I remember this one woman who was a banker, a very successful banker, and she was really unhappy in her job. She was very good at getting the clients in and taking care of them, but she just really could not see doing, and she did it because she was good at it, she was well paid, she felt responsible, all very proper reasons, but she felt kind of flat about it. And so we did this exercise that I called your ideal day, in which if money, geography, and other things were not constraints, what would your ideal day look like? What would you do first thing in the morning? Where would you wake up? Where are you living? And you can choose your place, maybe not Mars, but, you know, pick your place. And what is the first thing you do? Do you go to a desk and work at a home office? Do you get in a car and drive to a downtown office? Do you get on a bicycle and you pedal off to a country setting? What is it you do to get there? And then once you're there, what does it look like? How many people are around you? What are they doing? Where do you go? And what are you doing? Et cetera, et cetera. And you take it piece by piece. And what it is it may not be the template for what you end up doing, but what it does is it starts to give you directions as to what it is that would make you happy. And then you work backwards. So in the case of this woman, well, here she was in Seattle, Washington, at a major, with a very corporate job. And where did she wake up in her ideal day? She woke up in the south of France in a small village, stone house. And she never lived in southern France. And where did she go? She went down the road, and she ended up in a stone building with about 100 people working inside. And what were they doing? And what they were doing was designing and selling very high-end textiles. And I said, textiles? I said, do you weave? Do you sew? She says, no, I just love the touch and feel of them. I just love to see them, to be with them. I said, well, you want to go back to art school and learn that? No. I want to do operations. That's what I do. But I want to be around it. So what happened eventually, so she went back to the bank, and these things don't happen overnight, but what she was able to do was to get a position in her bank that had a strong operations component, and that taught her how to do operations, and she eventually did find a textile firm. It was in the United States, not France, but ended up in her perfect place. But she did that by allowing herself to dream and realizing what it is that made her happy. And then being, you have to be constructive about it, that when I was from law to real estate, I had to make sure that I had my front and back door available. So I was preparing, and I spent a long time thinking about the cost of not going after partnership at this law firm at the time. And so you have to evaluate the things, but I was able finally to choreograph my transition in a way that worked. Patience pays off, and paying attention.
I love that. Yeah, you just said choreographed your transition, and I think that's something, you know, to make a little asterisk by, or to make note of if you're out there listening today, because the people who tend to have the careers or the jobs of their dreams and are fulfilled and find happiness, they don't do what we call reactive job hunting. They do exactly what Julie just said, which is they choreograph, they design, they look at and they create and invent what they want their lives to look like. I think it's so important to take that time that Julie just mentioned to envision and to, you know, for lack of a better word, visualize what it is you want rather than just going out there because you're frustrated with your boss or your leadership team on a particular day and throwing caution into the wind and jumping at the first thing that comes to you. I think it's very important to be clear on what you want. And it's funny, Julie, that we're talking about this. Actually, my guest, Julia Dederer, at the end of the month on July 31st, she is doing a very interesting segment with us on how do you invent the next 30 years of your life from 65 on? Because people are living longer than ever. And, you know, that's a whole other conversation about how sometimes when we retire from life and just stop living. But I feel like some of us, before we even ever hit retirement, we retire from our passions, from our desires and our joys and our dreams. And no matter what age you are, whether you're 20 or 85, I think that we all have the capacity to continually be reinventing and redesigning our lives. And like you said, choreograph what you want rather than just react into what you don't want.
Oh, I think that sounds like an excellent program. And I agree that whatever age you're at, it is life is a series of experiments. That I, one of the things that I see happen a lot with people looking for careers is they spend a lot of time in their heads and on paper, but they don't go out there and try things. And you learn a lot by being a volunteer, go visit somebody's office, spend time doing a project with someone. Is it's not all going to come at once. That's part of the choreography, is to allow yourself to test things, because you can't see how it's going to come out unless you get put in the middle of it. And I think too many people are afraid that, well, I don't know, what if I don't like it? Well, then you don't like it. But do it.
Yeah, give it a try. I mean, we all go through those different phases of our career, and you'll never know if you don't get out there and try and fail and figure out what motivates, inspires, and gets you out of bed every day and makes you want to get out of bed rather than just trudging to work begrudgingly and being mad and blaming everybody around you for your lack of happiness or fulfillment. The buck stops with you. So, Julie, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. You've given our listeners so much information. Again, your book, The Journey of Not Knowing How 21st Century Leaders Can Chart a Course Where There Is None. Please, to all of our listeners out there, go check it out. It's an extraordinary book. And Julie, if people want more information on your programs, on your leadership programs that you offer, or any other information they may want about connecting with you, where can they find that information?
The easiest is Julie at juliebenezet.com, B-E-N-E-Z-E-T. Also on that site, that's my author site, you can, if you click, sign up for the newsletter, modern day thing, is I have a document I give away called Pioneer Your Career in the 21st Century, 10 Rules of the Road. So I'd be, if you sign up, I will send that out, and I'm happy to take questions for him.
Fantastic. Well, Julie, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. I think you've given our listeners a lot of food for thought and how they can go out there and create their dream jobs. So if anybody missed the whole show, you can always find it on the archive portion of the LA Talk Radio website on the Get Yourself the Job landing page. Additionally, you can also find it on iTunes later in the week if you go to Get Yourself the Job in the podcast section of iTunes. We invite you to leave us comments, to rate us. Any feedback you have is always welcomed. And we also have a Facebook page. If you have any guests you'd like us to have on the show or any additional feedback or would like an opportunity to interact with myself or any of our guests, please don't hesitate to find us on the Get Yourself the Job Facebook page. So thank you again, Julie, and tune in next Monday at 4 and have a wonderful rest of your week.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.